same sort of position where usually I think my head's usually like low down on screen, which is a bit shit. So the idea is if we're both boxes, this your head should be slap bang in the middle, which is what we're at. So I think we're all right. But yeah, standing desks are better, man. Definitely sorts my back out. I'm sitting down, but I'd like to stand if I could. Anyway, we're live, folks. We are back with Brain Food Live on air. It is episode, I think it's episode 72, could be episode 73. I can't even remember. But we are bringing it to you every Friday afternoon with another quality topic and amazing guests to talk about some recruiting brain food. Quick shout out. Basically, we need to do some AV sound testing and all that kind of palaver. So if you can hear me on Crowdcast, can you please comment and say, hello, Hung, I can hear you. We are multicasting, folks. Multicasting on LinkedIn Live, which, by the way, no one is watching these days. I don't know whether anybody else is doing LinkedIn Live, but my numbers have totally crashed. I don't know why. But for the five people who are watching right now, can you please just let me know that you can hear me, because I still care about you. And Facebook, I believe we're broadcasting on Facebook as well in the group. So if you can hear me in the group, please say hello. You can hear me. Okay, I think we're doing okay. Have I actually published in the group? I have. Okay, I think we're ready to go. Fantastic. Quick word to our sponsors before we kick off the show. This episode is sponsored by our friends at Pass. Pass Technology, folks, they are a referencing background checking tool. It is the one-stop shop for you if you wanted to really scale up your referencing checking procedure. Super important these days because we've lost so many more signals in the recruiting process now that we're all distributed working and what have you. We really do need to amp up the amount of assessment after the fact before we actually start rolling out employment contracts. So check out Pass Technologies. They are a cool business. I will share the link in the chat stream. And you can also find them out in the description as well. Okay, cool. Well, let's get on with the show. We are going to be talking about a super interesting topic today, unconscious bias, particularly unconscious bias when it comes to aesthetics and personal appearance. I think this is something we're all very familiar with, either victims or perpetrators or whatever it is. We're all part of this. It's quite a human kind of reaction, but obviously quite problematic also when we're talking about trying to treat people fairly when we're doing the job of recruiting. So we've got a bunch of amazing guests to come on with us and talk through this show. But before we dive into that, as always, we go through a quick review of Recruiting Brain Food last week. And we have Adam Gordon, our co-host, to help us do that. So, Adam, how are you doing, sir?
I'm great, thank you. and I've got some trivia for you. So I was on a podcast yesterday called The Recruitment Flex with Shelley and Serge.
Ah, cool.
I think you've been on it.
I have, yes. Great,
yeah,
guys.
I got asked, how did... So you're Hung's wingman on Brain Food Live. When did you first meet Hung? I was like, right, well, actually, I wonder if Hung knows this, because I had an answer straight away. Any idea?
It was in a bar. And I actually didn't like you at all. I thought, because this is in the moment of Brexit, it was about 3 years ago, and I was like hyped up because I was like so hostile to the idea. You were pro-Brexit at the time. No. You definitely were. And I just thought, who is this guy? He's really getting on my tits. And our relationship really was not going shaping it well. But that was my first time we met, I'm pretty sure.
You're definitely confusing me with Jacob Madsen or somebody else. Like, the first time you met me was on the 24th of October in a bar called the Canadian Embassy in Paris next to the exhibition center. I don't remember that you didn't like me. I was wearing a kilt and I don't think I was ever I was never pro Brexit, that's for sure.
You were pretending, at least you were pretending to be pro-Brexit, or at least blasé about the result. And I was like, oh, I was devastated by it. So anybody who was like sharing some pro-Brexit stuff at the time, I was like really having a problem with. And yeah, I remember that. But
if
somehow
that was
we got
Brexit,
over
Brexit, no way. You just didn't understand my accent. I was furious about Brexit.
I lived in Scotland for 5 years. I totally get it. But yeah, good show. Everyone should check out that podcast, Recruitment Flex. Fantastic, new podcast from our friends in Canada. And great to see podcasting generally escape the US, UK kind of thing, because there's loads more great recruiters and broadcasters in different spaces in the world there. And we should totally open our eyes and ears to those as well. Yeah, fantastic stuff. I look forward to hearing. When's the episode coming out?
Today.
Cool. I'll definitely check it out, man. Right.
Cool.
So Recruiting Brain Food, last week, did you read it?
Yeah, I did. So the first thing is, you nearly got me into trouble with my HR department because you included a link to go and take a look at that site where people post naked pictures of themselves.
Oh, yeah. OnlyFans.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm only kidding. I didn't nearly get into trouble from HR. But I found that really interesting how people can just make money out of posting pictures of themselves. You know, there's a million different ways that we can make money today. And it actually links in nicely with the article about the unbundling of, the unbundling of work. As platforms change, and when I say platforms, I don't necessarily mean just online, but as companies deconstruct, what it means is there's lots of opportunities for people to fill in the gaps and to satisfy demand in areas which hasn't really existed in the past. So, absolutely found both of those articles interesting, and I linked them completely.
Yeah, on those two points, by the way, OnlyFans is massive. I mean, I didn't really know about it until I read about this and then suddenly dug into it a little bit more. But for people who don't know, essentially it is, it's kind of like Instagram, but it's basically people pay to follow certain broadcasters, content creators, so to speak. Typically, it's just normal people that are prepared to share their privacy and intimate moments, let's say. And people make money that way. And it's a kind of a style of work, which a lady called Lee Jin, who wrote the unbundling work, calls the passion economy, which is essentially, can you make money out of building an audience, which is, as a matter of fact, something that Brain Food is trying to do, building an audience and kind of building a business off the audience. OnlyFans is sort of a version of that, only it's about nakedness and it's kind of like pornography. However, the Vanity Fair article, is it Glamour magazine article? They were quite critical of it. I think they were saying, look, this is, you know, quite dangerous, etc. I'm not sure. It probably is not ideal, but at the same time, it seems to me like a democratization of this way of making money. You know, I mean, if you want to do it, then there's a way to do it. It seems that you get more money doing this way than any other way of, you know, sharing your pictures. You know, if you were sending them to Page Three in the Sun, you're going to get like 300 quid or something. Here, at least you can get a subscriber. You know, so it's a way, I think, out of the unemployment apocalypse for some of us. We're going to be able to develop fans and we're going to be able to make money off that. So yeah, super interesting links. I would recommend everyone check them out. It's interesting to see how money can be made going forward.
I haven't read The Sun for a long time, but I've got to be honest, I don't think Page Three was ever user-generated content. To be honest, I think that they went out and found the people to be on.
This is true. However, I think that those girls were paid nothing. It was like, oh, here's 300 quid, be famous, and that was it. And you know, newspapers selling like 5 million copies or something. You know, so it was like getting far. Murdoch was getting 99.9% of all the value. Whereas here, OnlyFans, it seems that you get at least a bigger percentage to your own bank balance, which seems to me makes sense. Even though I totally understand, you know, it's not simple. You know, there's some other things to think about there. So, anyway, related maybe to our topic today. But go on. What else was interesting, Adam?
The six sort of alternative career options for people in recruitment. If you go and if you've got skills in recruitment, you can translate them to, quite clearly, you can translate them into HR. I can see that link. You could also translate them into sales. I can see that link as well. I think that translating them into marketing depends on whether or not you're a good recruitment marketer, because if you are, then absolutely, translating that straight into mainstream marketing, I get. I think you co-authored this, did you? Or you provided some input to this article.
I'm interested to know
how developer could be a link. I found that one a little bit more abstract.
Yep, I agree. So the post was written by Luke Shipley over at Zinc, who actually produces some really great content. And basically, he asked me to look over it, and I said, okay, it's fine. I'm happy to give input. But at the same time, it's got to be very explicit that I'm giving input whenever that type of situation occurs. So I give him some guidance on that. I think the developer was interesting because there's probably a branch of recruiters that are super technical in the sense that they are, you know, technical sources, they're able to write scripts and automate their work and stuff like that. And those types of people, I think, could transition into some sort of tech role along those lines. Whether you go straight into being a hardcore, full-on software engineer, probably not. But there's a few people out there that have technical skills that that have made that transition. And one of the rules I kind of set with Luke was that, listen, you shouldn't put in an alternative career path for a recruiter unless you can cite an example of someone who's made that move. And he was able to do that. So there have been recruiters that have become software engineers as a result of it, which is fascinating. So just to give a bit of context, this post is all about, hey, listen, we kind of got to be sensitive to alternative career paths for recruiters right now. That's normal. Recruitment is an oscillating kind of industry. You know, whenever there's a big crash or a contraction, a lot of people slide out, take 3 years, 4 years, whatever, and then maybe come back in. You know, what are the alternatives out there? And I thought that was a useful post and a popular one. It was the most popular one that week. So that tells his own story.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, one more.
There's a few others. Which one to choose? I guess the one that I'm most interested in is automation technologies, and the guy's post about how he got a job working in an Amazon warehouse without having talked to a human.
Right.
I don't know whether that was Amazon directly or whether that was Pontoon Solutions, who have been building these solutions, including for like recruiterless solutions, including for Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
This is not how we're going to get jobs in warehouses in the near future. This is how we're going to get a lot of jobs in the near future, including into sort of traditional kind of white collar jobs as well. There's a lot of jobs that you're not going to be talking to a human, and certainly until the hiring manager stage.
Yep, and even if there is a hiring manager, I mean, with Amazon, this is the work performance is algorithmically organized. So, you know, they'll monitor your performance. They'll literally, you know, be able to give you updates, see how you're doing, how many toilet breaks, monitor everything. So there is no real room for a manager there. It is a job. It's not a career. You know, I think Amazon are pretty clear on that. You're a shelf stacker, essentially. You're coming in to work in the warehouse. Here's your money. Here's the deal. You know, I'm not sure they're presenting a career path for this particular type of job. And they're just saying, hey, here's the pay, here's the job, come and do it. And for that type of function, that type of role, you probably don't need a manager. If people can monitor your performance, let's not forget, we call it a line manager. Why? Because that manager looks after the line, assembly line. And what is that guy doing? He's literally monitoring whether you're doing it fast enough. And if the machine can monitor that and software can monitor that, no need for you to be there.
One thing I haven't quite appreciated, and I don't know whether you're assuming this or you actually know this, is that, do these people actually have no manager or not? Because that's pretty radical, and I haven't heard that.
If you think about what a manager is, in a warehouse, you don't really need, I mean, yes, there's the foreman. I mean, I guess it's different levels, right? But for the job this guy was doing, and I've just shared the link in the chat screen, by the way, the job this guy was doing, I think, was the standard, you know, you got to move these boxes around, which is something the robot can generally do anyway. It is monitored by software. You know, you can actually figure out, okay, this person is doing it a very good job. He's efficient. He's doing well, etc. Tick the box. A manager, I think, may still be required when you are talking about things like career development. Let's say I hire you and I actually care about your future, which as a business, I shouldn't be obliged to do that. You know, if it depends on the deal, right? But if I want to build that type of company where, hey, you know, I expect the loyalty back in some way, you're going to be 3-year commit to me, I'm going to build your skills and, you know, all the rest of it, then yeah, that's where you might need a manager or a career developer or something like that.
You can test loyalty with pulse checks, and you can give them the career path with some kind of, you know, org structure and get them to just a position where they want to be next year and the year after. I'm not even sure humans need to do any of those things.
At some point, this is the future, man, and we're pointing directly towards it. I don't think we can deny it. The question is whether it's a good thing or not. And I think the author in this case generally came down on the fact that he didn't think it was a good thing. He ended up citing a load of examples about, you know, why this is bad experience, et cetera, et cetera. But you know what? My comeback to that is, you know, if you thought introduction of human recruiters automatically means better candidate experience, just go onto Google and type recruiters are, and then see what the recommendation engine gives you. We've had 30, 40 years to try and give candidates great experience. We can't do it. So I don't think putting human recruiters in there necessarily means better experience for the candidate.
We need more design thinking in recruitment. That's 100% for sure. Because that'll enable us to remove a lot of the recruiter forgot to call me back and stuff like that. And I think that that's something which will accelerate. So we have been at it for 30, 40 years, but at the same time, I think we're moving into an age where we can't not make changes now.
Yeah, it's going to be huge. I mean, I think the changes will come at the organizational level, as you intimated with regards to, you know, the dissolution of the company as an idea. I think that's definitely going to happen in large part, and that will actually transform what recruiting is. Maybe even render recruiting as an activity to be a little bit redundant itself. But we'll explore that as we go, topic for another time. Point of today's show, beauty bias. You started the conversation, actually, Adam. I forget where you posted, maybe in the Facebook group or something, but we talked about good-looking people get plus when it comes to recruiting, right? I mean, you're good-looking, I'm good-looking, he's good-looking, she's good-looking, whatever. That means convert on interview, convert on video interview, better promotion prospects, better whatever. Someone who's not good looking or whatever, unconventional looking, let's say, penalized. So what do you understand about beauty bias before we kind of bring in our guests who, you know, operationally recruiting at it and know a little bit more? You and I sort of speculate on the sidelines as non-recruiters now, but what's your experience of beauty bias? Have you been conscious of it before in the past as a recruiter, and when did you kind of understand this was a thing?
Well, I mean, I think I probably understood very, very early. So when I remember my uncle, my mom's cousin, used to come to our house on Boxing Day every year, and he used to bring a different girlfriend every year, and each time she was beautiful. What did I do? I went and climbed up on her lap straight away. I was immediately attracted to go and...
I need to know how old you are here, man. I mean, so I take like it you're a
three,
kid,
right? 3, 4, 5,
okay,
6.
Okay, I get it. Christ.
Not like in my 20s, no.
Yeah. Holy shit, man. Right, I get it.
So, you know, and so when I was like a little kid, why did I do that? Because they look nice.
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, I didn't... It's not because I was, you know, sexually attracted to these people. I wasn't. I was 3, 4, 5 years old. It's because they looked nice. Right? Yeah. There's something inbuilt in our brains to think that good-looking people means good in some way.
There's lots of evidence from an evolutionary point of view. It's all about symmetry of face and stuff like that, which basically means genetic fitness or what have you, and it means health. So it means that, okay, this person is not diseased. So when you're a kid, you may be drawn to people with more symmetrical faces. This has been sort of, there's been experiments where even kids younger than 3 or 4 years old, like baby level, if you show them an asymmetrical face, they get really uncomfortable with it. So there's all kinds of evolutionary biology involved and all this kind of stuff. And there's a reason why we promote beauty over most things, but it's obviously fundamentally unfair in the context of recruiting. You know, it's clearly a problem because you have, there's all kinds of layers to this. You know, there's what is beautiful. That's also culturally specific. And also, you know, it's not only biological, but there's a cultural layer on top, should I say. It may also be about social status. It may also be about race. You know, we know what is the beauty standards, typically are white beauty standards that roll across the world. And then obviously everyone who's non-white is trying to apply themselves to a standard that they can't reach be kind of judged that way. So yeah, hugely problematic.
India, that's really prominent. Absolutely. Then I guess the other thing about it is, it's absolutely conditioned in us, and it's conditioned in us not just through that nature, but through like media and culture.
Like, of course,
He-Man is much better looking than Skeletor.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Good and evil. Attached to beauty. Yeah.
Exactly. So that's another thing. But then where I didn't, I used to find it semi amusing, and now I'm 43 years old. Maybe that's partially why. I don't know. I think it's really distasteful now. When I walk into a PR agency and I look around and everybody is good looking and I'm like, this is a problem. I walk into a recruitment agency and it's the same. I walk into an events company. I walk into an event and I'm greeted by a bunch of often female, probably three quarters female, quarter male, that sort of thing. Everybody looks, you know, is beautiful. It's these people. People have not been given jobs with that company because they're not as good looking as those people who have been hired.
Right. I mean,
that's a problem.
So for people watching this, I mean, the examples that Adam's described, can you kind of anecdotally confirm some of this? Because I think that from my side, definitely, you know, I remember dealing with marketing agencies and PR agencies in particular. Unbelievable, right? It was just walking into like a catwalk. Everyone was like just a knockout, and you think, holy crap, that's obviously part of what it is there. And
it's prominent in our industry as well. I mean, it's prominent in recruitment. I'm not saying specifically, you know, Hayes or Michael Page or these companies. I am. I've just named them. You walk into those companies, the average person's much better looking than the average person walking down the street.
Right. Right. And I tell you another thing, leaving agencies world aside for a moment, but any kind of consultancy or client facing type of business seems to also be this way. You go to a McKinsey or you go to a Bain consultancy, some of these, you know, blue chip type consultancy businesses. I'm seeing perfect teeth. I'm seeing, you know, these people are like completely in the top 10% in terms of aesthetic appeal. And you think, okay, that's, there's a uniform, almost a biological uniform there, if you like.
I think that's a bit more of an image. I think what we find is, and when you, depending on the intellectual levels that people need to be operating at to do certain things. If you go into McKinsey, they can't just go and hire people that, you know, or out of the cast off Baywatch. They can't.
You're right. I actually don't think people are hired for that reason. But I think with regards to the blue chip type businesses, it's probably something that's associated with elitism and socioeconomic kind of strata as well, in the sense that these people are richer, they've had better healthcare, better nutrition, better everything. And then you're going to end up looking better. I mean, that's part of it, right? So
it is true. I mean, even at university, I mean, I had friends that went to universities like yours, like St. Andrews. You walk around St. Andrews University,
good looking
people. Walk around, you know, some other universities less prestigious, not as good looking people.
This is pervasive in society. Yes. Major diversity problem, right? When we're doing face-to-face interview, I'm looking at, and I'm, this unconscious bias is triggering, I'm going to basically award mental points higher to someone who's good looking compared to someone who's bad looking. with potential caveats. I mean, upon occasion, I've seen good-looking people be penalized for this, actually, because they're too good-looking. And it's like, okay, that's going to be a problem in the office. Get rid, unless there was a spectacular reason why this individual is great. Boys and girls for this reason, actually. I remember very recently, there was a guy who I worked with in a startup who was a model. He's a good-looking dude, 6'2". You know, perfect teeth, etc. Nice guy, everything. But he was like lambasted for that.
That's the whole of smart recruiters, isn't it?
There's some ugly people. No, there isn't. Anyway, let's get on with it. Let's bring some more intelligent people to the conversation here, because we're rattling this around, and I want to bring on a couple of active recruiters, because and Petar, I will bring you on in a bit, but I want to bring on Aaron, Matthew, and Charlotte Johns first, because they're currently recruiting. I wonder whether it's on their radar screen. That's the first thing I want to ask, because we talk about diversity, we talk about debiasing, are we debiasing on aesthetics? I wonder whether that's the case. I'm anticipating not, but I'd be interested to know what these two would say about it. So Aaron, I'm going to bring you on now. Charlotte, if I can see you, which I think I will in a sec. Yeah, cool. I'll bring you on also.
I mean, I'm going to say something that's going to sound really awful, but I'm just going to tell you the truth, because this is how I feel. If I meet somebody who's really good looking and then they start talking to me and I'm like, wow, you're really smart, I'm surprised.
Right.
And that's awful. But
it's not. That's the reverse bias. That's the downside of being beautiful sometimes, is that people don't take you seriously, or they don't credit anything else. Like, for instance, you might be so attractive. I'm guessing, but you know, if you're of this type of appearance, which is a stunner, people may never get beyond that. That may be the thing. Anyway, there's Charlotte Johns. Charlotte, how are you doing?
Hi. I'm good, thanks. How are you both?
I'm very well, very well. Welcome to Brain Food Live on Air. I believe this is debut on the show, Charlotte.
I'm very excited.
Welcome.
Great to see you. And it is super interesting. And for people who don't know you, Charlotte, can you quickly introduce yourself and what it is you do? Because you've got a new job, actually, haven't you? So let's tell people about that.
I am a sort of diehard recruiter. I've headed up teams at Transport for London, Legal in General, British Airways, and lots of others in between. And those were my sort of head of roles. And I've done lots of sort of consultancy and D&I work in between for organisations like Standard Chartered and Credit Suisse. Currently I'm at the Wellcome Trust, which is a fantastic place to be. And they're doing a number of sort of talent acquisition stroke people type of projects. And it is a really interesting place to be working at the moment, because we are all about COVID and all about research into the medical world. And our director is a very outspoken member of the SAGE committee. So it's been a very interesting time to join there. I joined 2 weeks before lockdown. So I have spent most of my Wellcome career looking at people through a camera screen, which is very intimidating.
Yeah.
You've got a new chair and a new CEO as well there, I think, isn't there? There's quite a lot of new leadership.
We have got a new chair who starts next year. So it is, now I can't remember her name. She was the president of Australia.
Julia,
yes, Julia. So she was, so she joins next year. We've still got, and we've got Jeremy Farrow, who's our director, and a really interesting group of people to work with. And it's actually the first place where I haven't seen sort of beauty bias being so prominent, because people respect the beautiful minds of the people that work in research in this kind of world. It's all about intelligence.
This is super interesting segue into the topic, Charlotte, because you know, this is a fascinating topic, isn't it? And I've got to be honest, I think it's sort of hidden, like we don't want to deal with it. There's some other conspicuous diversities, if you like, that I think we're all kind of aligned and on board with. But I haven't seen any movement to sort of say, hey, listen, we need to really think about the aesthetic side of it. And, you know, are we you know, over-indexing unconsciously on the good-looking people and getting them these opportunities. And we know the data on it. And Patrick, actually, thank you for sharing your data both here and on LinkedIn on all kinds of life impacts, you know, from legal sentencing, for instance. If you're good-looking or rated better-looking or whatever, you get like lighter sentences. You look at sort of people's height, often considered a beautiful thing for guys. The higher you are, you basically get better promotions, better salaries, better whatever. So pervasive throughout society. But let's talk about how it is in our world, recruiting. What's your experience of hiring in a non-biased way, dealing with this particular issue of appearance? Has this been a thing that you've got experience with before, Charlotte, or is it something that has been hidden and it's not something that we've dealt with?
I think it's really interesting because one of my previous roles was for a consulting organization, and the hiring message there was that we have to go into, in fact, two roles I've had in consulting, being head of recruitment there, and both of those, it was, we need to hire people who are going to be able to go into any situation and kind of blend in, so they shouldn't stand out for any reason. So it's kind of, I mean, it was the unspoken rule, you know, they shouldn't be too beautiful or too ugly or too short or too tall, you know, so they could kind of follow that kind of, yeah, we will fit into any situation seamlessly and be trusted and not doubted. So I think that was that's probably you know, and it wasn't so much sort of spoken about, but it was very much part of the decision-making process, I guess, in both organizations.
Yeah.
Was it's this never some MI5 or something?
I wish. No, not MI5. But yeah, you know, I mean, I think that that's part of that kind of fitting into the world of consulting, where you can almost have that chameleon-like, you know, that you can blend into whichever scenario you find yourself put into. And if you are extraordinarily beautiful or extraordinarily tall, unless, you know, or extraordinarily ugly, I guess, but ugly is down to perception. Tall and beautiful, I guess, are fairly commonly held beliefs. But yeah, I mean, I guess those ones were hard to, you didn't want to stand out too much.
I tell you what, this is probably an extreme level of beauty where it becomes problematic. You know what I mean? I think most people, maybe there's a spectrum of it where, you know, there's people on the lower end who obviously may have, you know, conspicuously not attractive, and you know that they have a bunch of challenges. Most of us are somewhere in the middle, but you know, plus or minus one way or the other. And then it gets to the point where, all right, if you're upper quartile, let's say, generally speaking, that's where you get all of the pluses. You are conspicuously, you are good looking, better than average. Everyone thinks you're better than average. You're going to get these plus points. But then you might end up being too good looking, like my friend who is the startup guy. And he was disparaged. He had to carry that. You know, he had to basically always handle the fact that he was model-esque, in, like a stunningly good looking guy. Yeah. And obviously so. But he wasn't taken credibly. He wasn't not considered. He was like considered dumb because of this.
Yeah. And I think that what you were talking about before about the agencies and those kind of salespeople being really, you know, really beautiful, because you buy that beauty, you buy that kind of that attractive person that comes along and is fawning all over you and making your ego feel good, you know, and selling at you. And then right. When it comes down to delivery, you get the kind of back office people who are just going to, you know, who aren't those front of house gorgeous ones. And I think that you see that often in our industry, and particularly in the agency world.
What can be done about this? I mean, this is so, you know, what you've just described is absolutely correct. And this is a clear discrimination that's happening. So
yeah,
should something be done about this? Is it too ambiguous a subject?
I was reading a study earlier on about somebody who said that, you know, they would love to do some research, but in order to do the research, they'd have to say, you know, can all the ugly people please step forward? And that in itself would just feel so wrong, you know, but you kind of have to, you know, ugly and beautiful is very much a personal view, isn't it? Yeah. So how do you study it?
It's so difficult to handle, but it's one of those that we kind of viscerally understand is there. Does the face fit? We've heard the euphemisms in recruiting, or the person's face doesn't fit. Not quite us. You know, that this kind of thing, and you sort of know what you mean by that. It's like you basically have a problem with this person's appearance. I want to talk a little bit about whether it's a legitimate assessment. Like, we're talking about best fit for job. This is now heading towards tough territory, right? Best fit for job. This is a sales role. We know that people have this bias towards more attractive people. Therefore, I'm hiring an attractive person. Therefore, I think that person is going to be a better salesperson as a result of their attractiveness. Is that a legitimate way to actually recruit somebody?
I would argue that there's a lot more to it than that. You know, that's a factor. I mean, thinking of Adam, aged questionable, sitting on people's laps, you know, I mean, I think that as a child, you know, I similarly had sort of my parents' friends coming through the house. And if there was an attractive man, I would probably do the same thing. And, you know, but it was also that they were funny and that they were confident and, in some case, you know, well-dressed, smelled nice, age sort of four. I remember, you know, my aunt's boyfriend always smelled amazing. I couldn't tell you what he looked like. But, you know, so I think that there are an awful lot more sort of senses that we could appeal to as well as how people look. So we do need to get deeper than, you know, the sort of aesthetics and somehow find a way to sort of harness that, you know, the confidence, the knowledge, the ability, the selling, closing a sales deal is not something all beautiful people can do.
No, but it's not in isolation. No, I'm talking about, is it a factor that we can actually recruit for? I mean, I think it's probably illegal in the UK. Someone tell me whether that's possible to do, to say.
I'm sure it's.
Well, it is. Yeah. Oh, no, I don't think it is illegal. If you go and look at British Airways cabin crew policy, you can't be under a certain height. You can't be over a certain height.
Good point.
You know,
good point.
So it's absolutely not illegal.
And that's because of health and safety. If they're too short, they can't reach the overhead lockers.
Is that BS though? Because otherwise it's men and women have different heights. So, you know, or is that true? I mean, if someone who works in Airways, please let me know. But I'm pretty certain Adam's correct in the sense that the height kind of restrictions are based on gender also. So you can't actually make the case that it's about health and safety. Because, you know,
I think it's also to do with the individual and how they feel about themselves when they come to the interview. So people who are less good looking will not perform so well in an interview. I mean, I've had, you know, always been, you know, a bit overweight. And so I've always felt a little bit, you know, that impacts my confidence when I go for interviews. You know, I've been very lucky that I've got lots of other factors that have given me a really successful career and I'm very proud of what I achieved. But I still think, gosh, there's a, you know, a skinny woman in front of me or a skinny guy or somebody who looks better, you know, and I think that that is something that lots of people, you know, those bad voices in your head that you kind of bat out of the way very quickly are still very prominent. And someone who's been told perhaps as a child that they weren't so good looking or, you know, it's those kind of patterns that stick in your head. And I think unless there's a recruitment process that tries to overcome that and, you know, asks the right questions and breaks down some of those barriers, you need to make your candidates feel comfortable as well.
This takes it further and further into the realms of too difficult to solve a little bit.
It doesn't,
so
it? Sorry.
Again, well, what hung you earlier?
No, hang on. Well, I want to bring on someone who thinks they've solved it because I'm going to bring on Petar Vujasevich. I think that's your name, Petar. I do apologize for mangling it. But I've known Petar for a long time, and he's actually got a technical solution that is, I think, designed to eliminate this type of bias. And it's basically about removing it's a blind recruiting process. So part of the thing is to say, look, we accept that everyone is biased because this is a human thing. We accept that also it is not positive because it means that we've got a unfair way of assessing people. And we may have to do it in a different way. So Pera, welcome to Brain Food Live. Good to see you, man.
Good to see you as well. Good to be here. Also a first time guest on the show. So
a debut. Before we begin, Pera, can you quickly just introduce yourself to the audience, please?
I am part of Gap Jumpers. Some of you may have heard us about us. We have been working in the space of bias decision making in hiring, selection, promotion, and retention for the last 9 years. So we kind of know a little bit about bias, and mostly we just steal other people's ideas, particularly academics, and kind of rework them into products and services, which is basically what I'm going to be doing here today. So if anybody expects anything original from me, I'm like the Noel Gallagher of diversity and inclusion.
That is a great line to end any intro, Pera. And you know what? It's really interesting to get your view on this, because I've always kind of known you as a person that really cares about the de-biasing of the assessment side of things. How prominent do you think, you know, like what is the solution to this? I get it with a blind interview. Is that the way to do this? Like literally don't look at people?
No. Well, if you're Matt Mullenberg of Automattic, then yes, you go, you know, you just hire purely based on chat. But there is actually an interesting paper. If I can I share my screen just so that people can see the paper, and then I'll share the link because I have it on Sci-Hub. So I don't know if everybody can access it.
You share the link first, Petter, that'll probably be better. I don't think anyone's going to read it.
It's a paper which talks about attractiveness in the space of recruitment. And I'll just quote one paragraph, that two things that are interesting. First of all, they make the distinction between taste-based discrimination, which is discrimination unrelated to merit, which is what we generally call bias, and statistical discrimination, which is a preference based on an expected performance. You can either discriminate saying, hey, I just don't like you because you are man or woman, or I can say, you know what, I'm going to be hiring a attractive person because it is a factor that we can causally actually show that it is a factor in our hiring, and hence we will, hire people for particular roles that are slightly more attractive than the average. And one quote out of this research, just to set the context, is it says, on average, better looking people possess a slight advantage in human and a small but notable advantage in social capital compared to less attractive people. Now, they define human capital as, you know, your skills, your credentials, your actual ability to do the work, and social capital as being something that is in the realm of how can I make relationships, how can I, you know, fundraising, being a somewhat of a political person in an organization, and having those types of skills. So this particular paper cites that, you know, there is actually a lot of cases of what they call taste-based discrimination, where people just, let's be blunt, say, I don't want to hire ugly. But that's not always the case. There might be cases where, you know, the reason why people are being hired for a particular appearance is because it isn't actually a determining factor to succeed in that particular job. And this, you know, leads me to a possible solution. I'm not going to say I have the solution, but this would be a hypothesis that beauty bias, if you can call it that, usually goes hand in hand with a competency stereotype. And by competency stereotype, I mean that, you know, we always assume that we know what a good performance entails, and we're looking for the right person to fit the job. Whereas if you actually start to look at what is a good performance, what is the cause of a good performance? Can we actually causally isolate the factors of performance that we want to have? That is the basis, not just for beauty bias, but for any type of bias, to start mitigating that. Because you mentioned a very important word, Hung, and it's over-indexing. It's about, you know, it's not about disregarding beauty in my personal view. It's about making sure that it's weighted correctly within the overall assessment process. Now, again, if there is cost, statistical cost, run over a couple of hiring cycles or a couple of years of employees, that you can point to saying, hey, you know what, in this particular kind of role, beauty may or may not, it's actually a determining factor. You know, competency being equal, it can tip the scales to get more sales, get more funding, or get, you know, better team performance because the manager is more like, then there is a case to say, you know what, this is a case of statistical discrimination, meaning it is based on a particular outcome that we can link to. And as such, it should not always be disregarded. Now, the question, of course, is, do you actually know what causes great performance, right? If that foundation is wrong, then you're probably going to move into taste-based discrimination because you think that X is, you know, that beauty is a factor, whereas you don't know if beauty actually is a factor. So that's just, you know, what we can look at, you know, in terms of bias. It's understanding what does performance actually mean, how, what factors into a good performance, and if beauty is an element to that, then weigh properly.
So this is really interesting, Petter. What you're saying is a potential, again, you're right to say it's not a solution, but a mitigation that we could put into place is to understand what good looks like. And I hesitate to use the term looks because, you know, we're attacking that, but, you know, what good actually is, and then work regression plan it from there. In other words, figure out, okay, here's what a good performer does. Can we correlate those things to a bunch of factors, and how important is the personal appearance? How are we overrating the personal appearance? Correct. In many cases, maybe we are.
Well, it's a foundational thing to just look at any type of hiring situation, right? You just want to know, what am I looking for? If I'm hiring an engineer, what does a good engineer do? Because again, once you have a standard that is somewhat objective, recruiters can go far and wide because they just go, look, you know, these are the objective boxes that we're looking for. We're not looking for, again, Google, right? After thousands of data points, they figured out, you know, grade point average has no bearing. Well, okay, great. Now we know, right? So now we can factor in grade point average at the correct weight when we interview somebody or when recruiters go out. And they go, you know, it's not about having a, what is it, 2.2 in the UK or 2.1?
A 2.1 is generally perceived to be the bar, I think, in the UK. Okay.
So maybe a 2.1 is not what you're looking for, right? But if the perception is there, then you're making wrong decisions. And so that is just a foundational thing, you know, regarding any type of hiring decision. Again, it comes back to what I think the gentleman with the beard, Andrew?
Me, Adam.
Adam mentioned, right, about, you know, a particular college. Russell 20 Group universities are just perceived to deliver better people than if you go to a Brixton Community College. But there is absolutely no correlation if that's actually the case on jobs. So again, it's about figuring out what does performance look like. And then a lot of things become a lot clearer. And again, it's like saying in an interview, well, you know, people that interview well have a bias because they're, you know, they have the gift of the gab. Well, you don't want to dismiss that. You just want to put it in its proper context when you make that decision as a hiring panel to say, you know what, this particular person, yes, they had the gift of the gab, but, you know, in our assessment, it's only 10%. So the gift is only 10% worth of the overall picture instead of it being a halo whereby everything else gets crowded out because it's the only thing we remember.
So if you create the profile of the perfect person for any role, and part of that is, you know, how they perform, what they've done, what their exam results are, and a factor is how they look or the, you know, how they are perceived to look, how do you then create, you know, and I think that the challenge is then how you then create a recruitment process that enables you to consider that 10% of their successes could be based on how they look and 90% is not, and not have a recruiter who's blinded by the fact that they're particularly beautiful or particularly ugly.
Oh, well, that's a good question. And I've thought about that as well. And I've only come up with a very crude answer, which is don't have a singular recruiter make a decision, right? I mean, I might be blinded by Hung's beauty, but you might go and go, well, you know what? He's not really a good looking fella. So it can balance each other out, right? I mean, generally, you don't want to have a singular person making any decision, ideally. Now, perhaps in the pre-screen stage, at the initial top of the funnel stage, you can automate things, right? I mean, you know, auditions, assessments, whatever the case may be, you want to maybe anonymize that. You want to maybe remove the point of contact that a human has with another human to the point where it's actually necessary. Now, that might be, you know, a way to go about it. But in general, I think the biggest problem is yes, wisdom of crowd, maybe as Patrick says. But I think in general, if a singular person is going to make a determination, then you're always at risk of that particular person having perhaps a preference or an infatuation.
Jumping in right here, interesting that the direction of travel again is to dehumanize the process a little bit. Like, recruiters are going to walk in with bias. That's a fact. And if you're the recruiter as the top, you're the gatekeeper at the beginning of the funnel, let's say, then you're basically prejudicing the entire pipeline because of your particular bias. So maybe we need to be stepping back further down from the funnel and getting involved at a different point in the process, which it's a shocking revelation, right? I mean, 360 Recruiter run the entire thing. Most people who recruit still think that they legitimately would think that they are candidate hunters, finders of people, etc. But we can't potentially do that without loading in load of bias.
And again, without hogging the conversation, there's another, just two things I want to point out. One, is it possible that people in the chat, you know, maybe answer this question? How many of you use Zoom for candidate interviews?
They're going to take a while to type back, but I think
the answer is many of them.
Okay, I think a lot of them, yeah.
If beauty bias is something that you're against, then you should boycott Zoom. Because Zoom has a feature that says, enhance my picture,
appearance,
right?
So
any company that says, look, you know, we agree that, you know, Zoom, that the beauty bias is not a thing, don't use Zoom because candidates can actually enhance themselves as well, right? So it's, again, perpetuating the thing. I'm being a bit tongue-in-cheek here, but again, companies are kind of building an ecosystem that, you know what, hey, you know, here's filters. Make yourself more presentable. Make it all about, you know, that thing. Whereas if I can borrow slightly from a very underrated cousin of the behavioral science branch, which is the pickup artist community. Well, there the big problem is, right? The big problem there is you got a bunch of guys. Most of them are, you know, on the lower end of beauty. And their bigger problem is I want to attract a beautiful partner. So how do they counter that effect that they're not beautiful and they're going after beauty, which is
high volume? Like,
no, not high volume, yes. But once they have contact, it's about, let's say, the pickup line, right? Or in general terms, have a better story. As a candidate, it's my hypothesis that you can mitigate some of the beauty by actually wowing a recruiter with, you know what, you actually have a great story to tell. It's like cold emailing, right? Or a recruiter. A recruiter might say, the candidates are not responding to my emails. Well, what's your headline? Hey, you know, you want to work at my company. Nobody's going to be attracted to that. So again, you know, story might mitigate the visual. Again, just from a candidate point of view, because I don't want to put all the blame or the responsibility on the company side. But again, a good story can capture somebody's imagination that makes you forget their beauty as well, just as a sidebar.
So what about if you turn the camera off? So
great point. Absolutely.
There's a lot more power from having a Zoom conversation with the camera turned off than there is from having a phone call, weirdly. So I think
you know what, Charlotte, sorry to interrupt, but I reckon that's a terrible idea, because we've defaulted now to video on, and the worst thing you can do is to go video off and then assume people are going to just fill it in with something anyway. So in other words, let's say the impact of a beautiful person is to just make me feel good. If I'm speaking to a beautiful person, I just feel better because I'm interacting with this beauty here. So that's the first plus. But if it's a blank screen, that's worse than nobody there. It's almost like, why am I? Because my camera's on, that person's not. There's an equitable problem there. Yeah. I don't think that's good advice. I think we need to get camera on. We need to figure out how to get over the problem.
Yeah.
Zoom is maybe exacerbating it by saying, hey, here, make yourself beautiful. I don't know. I mean, I literally have no clue how to fix this particular issue.
Well, there's just a few other things, right? In America right now, in the state of Illinois, there is actually laws that have been enacted, particularly around video conferencing, video interviews, to actually start helping protect the rights of candidates. Now, the first draft of the law is that you can actually refuse to take part in a video conference, in a video interview, and they actually need to then give you an alternative. And now they're looking at legislation to actually get candidates to, you know, to be protected as well in terms of, hey, you know, what happens if I, you know, if I am not of the norm, how can I then still have a fair shot in the actual interview? So again, legally speaking, there are, you know, bits and pieces that people are trying to introduce. There's a couple of states in the US that have made height and weight a protected class. But in general, beauty is not something that has yet been legislated or is seen as a protected class. I mean, Abercrombie and Finch, I don't know if they exist anymore, but yes, back in the day, they got a $50 million fine because they were only hiring WASPy floor people, sales assistants on the floor. And the problem was that they were all beautiful, but that wasn't the problem. The problem was that they were all, you know, white. The moment they started hiring diverse, beautiful people, nobody had a problem with it from a legal point of view. So I think going down the legislative branch might be very difficult. And I think from my point of view, it's more about, okay, how do we actually make sure that the interview process, which has multiple steps, is weighted correctly so that you don't just make a decision on beauty, right? I mean, is there past performance? Is there an assessment? Is there a body of evidence that at the end of the entire process, you know, Adam and Hung and myself can say, you know, we sat down and this particular candidate, they're good because we know actually what performance looks like.
Let me move it on to, because we're running out of time here, I'm afraid, but because this is a fascinating conversation. Let's have a look at the world that we have now. Like we're talking about the beauty bias, I think very, very prominent back in the day when face-to-face interviewing is bring this person into the office, meet the team, et cetera, et cetera. Probably these are multiple points where the beauty bias is going to be more, we're going to see essentially it will be spread more because this person is exposed either way. But now we're in remote distributed work. Is that going to help? Because maybe we can all do the Matt Mullenweg, by the way, CEO of Automattic, a well-known distributed business, just remote-only business, never meet, no office, that kind of thing. Is that going to help people of diverse experience? Because you know what? Maybe that person is always just going to be an avatar and I can just see the work. I can just see the product. I don't need to ever meet this person. So beauty bias recedes. Charlotte, your thoughts?
I think that because of the industry that we work in, and because of my personality, I need to see people. And so, but I think that, so I think that an industry where, and sort of, if it, an industry where you don't see people, yes, you will respect the quality of the product. However, build such a strong relationship with it, you know, based on respect for the product, but not respect for the product. I'm not sure.
Okay, how about you, Adam? Your thoughts on this? Does remote working, distributed working, is that going to help in a strange way mitigate this issue of beauty bias?
I don't think it's going to make any difference, to be honest. And I also don't know whether it really is a genuine issue or not. It goes so, so deep into society. And we think about, you know, we talked about St. Andrews University. You walk around there, everybody's better looking than they are at, you know, some polytechnic that's now a university. But this goes, like, wealthy individuals get to choose, have better choices around who they might marry and therefore have children with. So it's all, you know, embedded into the culture of everything in humankind.
But that's why it is a problem, though, because you've got a social mobility issue, don't you?
I just think it's such a big one. I'm just not sure if it's. I think there's a lot of lower hanging fruit.
Also with a lot of people who I come into contact with in my job and in my social life have said that all of this time sitting on cameras, they are in the queue and the waiting list for the Botox, fillers, etc. So a lot of time sitting looking at yourself has a very negative impact on a lot of people, men and women of different ages.
Well, hang on. Erin, who I would try to bring on earlier, has just made a very interesting comment. And Erin, you're saying that basically, in fact, let's see if I can bring it back on. She's saying that essentially she's more comfortable feeling less attractive on camera than she was before because she's doing so many times on camera. And that's definitely true for me. Usually I put the makeup on and the lighting. No, I don't. But
you've got your crowdcast filters on, have you not?
Everything, mate.
I think it has gone in that there was a peak at the beginning, and perhaps it has died down a bit.
I think basically because we do it so often. Yeah. Like, you just have to deal with it. It's like, I have to get on with my day. I can't be like making sure my hair's all right and all this type of stuff. Yeah, she's here. Erin, how are you doing?
I'm great. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Sorry that we weren't able to bring you on, Erin. I know you've got loads to say about this topic. But let's jump straight into the last comment. You mentioned that actually you're giving less of a damn, essentially. Tell me about that.
So... originally, when I first started having Zoom meetings, I would look at my calendar for the day and I'm like, oh my God, I gotta do my makeup today. I gotta do my hair today. I can't look like a slob at work. But now that everyone's on Zoom, we don't have the energy to put that kind of effort in every single day. So I'm kind of at the point where I'm like, they value me at work for a reason. And it's not because of how I look. So I find myself allowing myself to, look a little bit normal on some days and not care as much about, dolling myself up for a video call. So I think that some people have had a little bit of that mind shift. I don't know if I'm the only one, but, we're more comfortable in our own homes. So we're less likely to, feel the need to wear anything other than sweatpants.
You know what?
Well, interestingly, I actually dress smarter before. So when I traveled, I'd put on a shirt and a blazer or something like that. But in my office, I'd wear a hoodie. Because I'm not in my office, funnily enough, I actually always put a collared shirt on. So I'm not sure. I actually have probably started looking a little bit smarter than I did. But that's maybe because I'm actually doing more customer meetings than I ever have done. Yeah, because they're happy to do them, because it takes 20 minutes instead of an hour.
That's it. And there's also more serendipity or spontaneity, should I say, about those customer meetings. So for your side, as if you're in sales mode, probably you're going to dress up more often because, on the off chance that the VC happens to be there, you've got to have a chat with them. But Erin, you mentioned something really interesting there, because that aligns with the theory that remote working should degrade the importance of the beauty bias, right? Because you're saying that, we're going to get more used to the fact that we are just human beings, and stuff happens out of our control, which we've all had situations in the background, stuff's happened, like the barrier between professional and personal has completely shattered, and maybe the beauty bias is associated quite tightly with that dichotomy. Where there's a public face, if you like, and you're dressed up and you're all in this. But now that's kind of shattered because actually, the dog's just taking a crap and you got to fix that. So maybe the authenticity is going to help a little bit. I don't know.
I think so. And Erin McDermott actually made a good point in the chat as well, that there's more of a tolerance for us being our real selves, on Zoom, because we're at home and life happens. And Jerry also made a good point. He said that my note makes sense for those whose value is already known within the company. But when you're interviewing for a job, of course it's different. Of course it is. Yeah, and, we've talked about this for over an hour about how we have these implicit biases that are just kind of always going to be there. But I think awareness of it is a good first step when it comes to that.
Yeah. And Petar came up with some ideas, which I think we all align with. Like, if it's a single recruiter, there's a problem. So if you care about this, maybe you need to have multiple people at least to do that verification. Maybe we can't eliminate the human bias. So maybe the recruiter steps down from the front of the funnel a little bit, use some automation, use some gaming technologies, use some sort of assessment that isn't based on appearance, that can kind of diversify your funnel, and only get the human being involved when the person you've already checked a few points. I mean, I think it'd be harder to apply a bias when this person's like aced a score that you care about. You're going to think, forget it, what it looks like. I need this person to deliver the skills. And, it's a mitigation thing there.
Can I just say that I think there is one thing that we can do about this. And I feel very strongly about, if you see something that makes you feel uncomfortable, you should say it. And of course, in 2020, I think this is more prominent than ever it has been. If you see evidence of sexism, or you see evidence of homophobia or racism or any kind of other bigotry, I think you should say it. Likewise, if you see somebody that's hiring people because, specifically because, they think that person is a babe, I feel like you kind of need to point it out, and you need to say it's not really acceptable. And maybe it's just me that thinks it's unacceptable, but certainly now I do feel uneasy when I meet somebody's colleagues and I look at them and go, there's a hiring policy, there's an active policy here, which is discriminatory. I feel like it's worthwhile pointing it out.
Yeah. And I actually, when you say that, it brings me back to my very first recruiting job that I ever had, which was with an experiential marketing agency. So that was an added layer of challenge, because being beautiful and attractive was basically a requirement for many of the positions we filled, which were mostly promo models for alcohol brands. And one of our clients, who is, you know, I won't name them, but they're the biggest distributor of beer in the world, they wanted a specific look for every beer that they had. For one of them, they said, we want blonde hair, blue eyes, and a girl that can do a French accent, which made no sense because it was an Italian beer. So, but they would openly discriminate. Yes. It was insane. And what I noticed was that the same bias eventually started to spill over into the recruiting department. And I watched my TA managers look up a girl's Facebook page of someone that I suggested that we interview. They said, she doesn't have the look we're looking for. And then I asked them point blank. I said, did you do this when I was interviewing? And they said, oh yeah. Yeah, we looked at all of your public photos on Facebook. And I said, well, I guess thank God I was cuter back then, because you know, maybe I wouldn't have gotten that job.
You know what? It's that kind of bleeding in of prejudice, I think that totally happens, doesn't it? Where if you allow certain type of bias to take hold, whatever it is, we're talking about beauty right now, but it could be whatever, that then ends up infecting other parts of the business. So you have to be really on top of this. Folks, this has been a fascinating chat. I really want to continue it. We should do like a beauty bias sort of part two, because this is one that would go on and on. Folks, if you're interested in this, for us to do a replay of this, please let us know in the comments, because I'd love to continue. We haven't talked about gender for a start, because does beauty bias affect in different ways? And in what way? You know, of course it does, you know. And who is the biaser? You know, who that is also gendered, I think. You talked about, you know, men looking at women, women looking at men looking at men. All of these things make a difference. We haven't talked about race either, which is hugely important when it comes to appearance. I've been reading a few posts about sort of hair, natural hair appearance, and how, you know, particularly in the U.S., where the African-American community get penalized for wearing their natural hair. And, you know, when you kind of see that, you think that's insane. But then you realize, of course it is, because basically everyone needs to straighten, because that's the default beauty standard. And even, you know, Caucasian people have a lot of my Caucasian friends would straighten their hair for a formal event or something, even if they had curls. Like, when did that happen as a thing that is more formal, to be straight head? That's weird. But anyway, we haven't talked about that. So I think part two would be amazing. I want to thank everyone for watching this show. We are over time, and I don't want to take any more of the day for everyone. Thank you for watching, everyone. And thank you, Pedar, for your amazing contributions. I'm going to look at your paper. That's fantastic. Charlotte Johns, thanks for coming on to the show. Welcome to it. We'll definitely get you back. Erin Matthew, thank you for being patient. Goodness me, you were like there for like an hour before we got you on, but you came in, you're firing bullets in 10 minutes, you got us there. And Adam, thank you for being co-host, man, always. Everyone, thank you for watching the show. It's been great having you. We're back next week. What are we talking about? We are talking about remote first, lessons from remote first businesses that they can teach companies moving to remote. So we've got Mark Dubo from Elastic. We've got Anastasia, whose second name I cannot pronounce, but she's a senior recruiter at GitLab. They're going to be talking to us about what remote only businesses can teach us about recruiting when we're all now shifting to remote remote first now. So definitely check that out. Follow the channel. Thank you again to our sponsors, Pass Technologies. Make sure you check them out if you are looking for a reference checking tool. We'll be back next week, folks. We'll see you in 7 days. Have a good weekend, everyone.
Bye.
Cool. Thanks, everybody. I thought it was a great conversation. I'd love to have continued it, actually. So many topics we didn't touch upon, but I really love the 2 points. I don't even know why I'm doing this behind the scenes. But the 2 points I think Petar mentioned, I think was super important. Basically, you get one recruiter at the top of the funnel. He or she is going to put the buyers into the pipeline. So you need to get two or at least more people to diversify that analysis. And secondly, right at the end, maybe you need to drop the recruiter, the human recruiter, down the funnel a little bit. Perhaps they're not so important doing that CV profile screen. Thanks everyone for listening. I appreciate it. Make sure you tune in to next week. We're going to do round 2 on this topic. It's fascinating. All right, take it easy.